Did you say restart? Survey of Revelation. Lost one already. She provided him not only with financial security, but with a great deal of encouragement and confidence as he later sorted out his religious experience. There was a sizable community of Jews in Arabia in the 6th and 7th centuries of the Christian era, and we can picture Muhammad as a young man sitting around the campfires of the caravans at night, listening to the stories that were told. Unfortunately, both the Judaism and the Christianity that Muhammad was exposed to were in very corrupted forms by the 6th and 7th centuries, and Muhammad could not read any source material for himself. This is crucial. Over the 22 or 23 years that he later dictated the 114 surahs or chapters that we know of today as the Quran, he regurgitated a great deal of what he had heard as he remembered it or changed it to fit whatever situation he was in. The Jews of Arabia in those days were more acquainted with the fables of the Talmud than they were with the Hebrew scriptures. Muhammad probably had no direct contact with the Bible, and even if he had, he couldn't have read it. Many stories in the Quran give the impression that something is missing, even to the point of being indecipherable. When you look at the Jewish legend, you find the source of that story and often the additional details that provide context and meaning to the story as found in the Quran. Much of the Quran contradicts the Bible and coincides with the Jewish legends current in Muhammad's day. Muhammad adopted his young cousin named Ali, who described his adoptive father at the age of 45. He said that Muhammad is of middle stature, neither tall nor short. His complexion was rosy white, his eyes black, his hair thick, brilliant, and beautiful fell to his shoulders. His profuse beard fell to his breast. There was such a sweetness in his visage, that no one once in his presence could leave him. If I hungered, a single look at the prophet's face dispelled the hunger. Before him, all forgot their griefs and pains. As Muhammad approached the age of 40, he became more and more absorbed in religion. On a night known as the Night of Power in 610, alone in a cave 3 miles outside Mecca, Muhammad had the pivotal experience of all Islamic history. Here's what he said. While I was asleep, with a cover of silk whereon was some writing, the angel Gabriel appeared to me and said, "Read." I said, "I do not read." He pressed me with the coverlet so tightly that methought 'twas death. Then he let me go and said, "Read." So I read aloud, and he departed from me at last. And I awoke from my sleep, and it was as though these words were written in my heart. I went forth until, when I was midway on the mountain, I heard a voice from heaven saying, "O Muhammad, thou art the messenger of Allah, and I am Gabriel." I raised my head toward heaven to see, and lo, Gabriel in the form of a man with feet set evenly on the rim of the sky, saying, "O Muhammad, thou art the messenger of Allah, and I am Gabriel." Muhammad had many similar visions and convulsions and swoon. Some of these may have been epileptic seizures, but we don't know. His first convert was his wife. His second convert was his cousin Ali. His third convert was his servant. His fourth convert was Abu Bakr, who brought 5 Meccan leaders along with him. And this was a turning point. In 612 AD, Muhammad began publicly converting the Arabian people. Long story short, eventually all Arabia submitted to his authority and to his creed. Muhammad protested for being taken for more than a fallible and mortal man. He claimed no power to predict the future. He claimed no power to perform miracles. Unlike Jesus, Muhammad could not point to hundreds of prophecies written about him before his birth. Jesus could, and he did, and he claimed deity. But I can't think of any prophecies about Muhammad that he could point to except for this 9th chapter of Revelation, and he wouldn't have wanted to point to that because it's not very complimentary. It's claimed that Jesus predicted the coming of Muhammad in John 16:13, when he talked about the coming of the Spirit of Truth. When he, the Spirit of Truth, has come, he will guide you into all truth. But to think that the Lord was talking about Muhammad there is just lunacy. The Quran repeatedly makes excuses for Muhammad's inability to perform miraculous signs to support his revelations. Jesus verified his teaching by his miracles. Where evidence does not exist, God does not expect people to believe. At the height of his power, Muhammad dwelt in cottages, mending clothes or shoes, kindling fires, sweeping the floor, milking the family goat in the yard. He shopped for provisions in the marketplace, he ate with his fingers and he licked them, and he obeyed his own prohibition against wine. He put on none of the pomp of power, he rejected any special marks of reverence, he asked no service of a slave that he had the time or strength to do for himself. Despite all the booty and revenue that came to him, he spent little on his family, spent less on himself, and a great deal in charity. It is said that the voice of Muhammad was hypnotically musical, and that his senses were painfully keen. Loud talk really bothered him. Bells or strong smells he could not bear. His friends loved him to the point of idolatry. His followers eventually began collecting his spittle when he would spit on the ground. If he got a haircut, they would collect the hair. If he washed his hands, they would collect the water that he had used, and expected magical cures from these things. Finally, in 632 AD, he died at the age of 62. And if we judge greatness by influence, he is one of the giants of history. When he began, Arabia was a desert filled with idolatrous warring tribes. When he died, it was a nation united religiously, politically, and economically. It was one in purpose. The religion of Muhammad made the Arabs what they became. And though Muhammad himself seems to have had no thought of power outside of Arabia, his successors were far different from that. Muhammad changed the map of Arabia. With the irresistible force of fanaticism, his followers changed the map of the world. A little bit about the text here. We see the locust in verse 3, referring to a numerous and destroying army. Few references about that. Judges chapter 6, verse 5, the army of the Midianites came as grasshoppers for a multitude. The head of the grasshopper and the head of a horse looks similar. Here we have, again, a little thing symbolizing a big thing. Nahum 3:15, make thyself as many locusts, when it's referring to military things. Joel, obviously, chapters 1 and 2, the locusts seem to be invading armies. Before them, the land is like the Garden of Eden. Behind them, a desert waste, it is said of these locusts in the book of Joel. They have the appearance of horses. They gallop along like cavalry. Joel chapter 2, verse 4. They charge like warriors. They scale walls like soldiers. Joel 2:7. The Lord thunders at the head of his army. His forces are beyond number, and mighty are those who obey his command. Chapter 2, verse 11. Joel's description of a locust plague as an invading army helps us to understand the imagery of the fifth trumpet. The locust itself, as an insect, is peculiarly Arabic. It was an east wind that brought the locust into Egypt at the time of the plague of locusts in the days of Moses. The locust bred out in those rainless deserts. The word Arab means arid. Arabia is the largest of all the peninsulas. It snows there once about every 40 years, but the nights can get down to 38 degrees. The sky is always clear. The Saracens, or the Easterners, had an army unlike any other nation. It was all cavalry. There was no infantry because infantry would not work in the desert. The followers of Muhammad absolutely hated idolatry. The church-state union under Constantine had over three centuries introduced many corruptions into the relatively pure church of the first three centuries. Constantine undertook to convert the kingdom of Christ into a kingdom of this world. Constantine exalted the teachers of Christianity to the same state of affluence and grandeur and influence as had been enjoyed by pagan priests and secular officers of the state. This exaltation of the bishops proved to be the source of every corrupt fruit. Such corruption within the apostate church left it ripe for the judgments of the fifth and sixth trumpets. Byzantium, or Constantinople, had brought in icons and tried to force them on the people. They decided that all people should worship according to them. So those who chose Islam would not have idolatry, and they went on the offensive and defaced the images, literally defaced the images. Wherever they found stone images, they would chisel the stone face right off of them. And some of you have been in countries where you've seen some of those. I remember seeing a number of them around Ascalon and Ashdod, for example. Literally chipped the face off the stone of the image. Many of these are still available around the world to be seen. In 632, after the death of the prophet, Abu Bakr and his army left Arabia. And since some of you just love to hear from Gibbon, I'll read a little bit from Volume 3. This is still Modern Library Edition, Volume 3, page 145. "Remember," said the successor to the prophet, this is Abu Bakr, "remember that you are always," this is what he's saying to his army, "remember that you are always in the presence of God, on the verge of death, and in the assurance of judgment and the hope of paradise. Avoid injustice and oppression, consult with your brethren, and study to preserve the love and confidence of your troops. When you fight the battles of the Lord, acquit yourselves like men without turning your backs, but let not your victory be stained with the blood of women or children. Now listen to this. Destroy no palm trees, nor burn any fields of corn. Cut down no fruit trees, nor do any mischief to cattle, only such as you kill to eat. When you make any covenant or article, stand to it and be as good as your word. As you go on, you will find some religious persons who live retired in monasteries and propose to themselves to serve God that way. Let them alone, neither kill nor destroy their monasteries." And you, that's probably as far as I should go there. The point is, there were specific commandments given to this army, and it's quite a contrast with the Goths. The Goths had a scorched earth policy, as we talked about earlier this morning, and they took out everything in their path. This army today, under the fifth trumpet, is not to destroy the things that they find. That's interesting, because with literal locusts, vegetation falls victim to their voracious appetite. But these symbolic locusts were not to harm the grass of the earth or any plant or tree. They were told not to do what by nature locusts are expected to do, destroy vegetation. They did not devastate the land. Instead, they left intact local custom, local government, local laws, local taxation, and to some extent even the local worship where they felt that they could. They collected tribute. The Saracens did not come to kill, but to conquer. This policy enabled them to form flourishing kingdoms out of the conquered nations. It was in marked contrast to many other conquerors like the Goths who left desolation behind them. The divine judgment was directed primarily against unbelievers and nominal Christianity. The Saracens killed those who opposed them in battle, who were primarily from the apostate church. The apostate church bore the brunt of this persecution. The pride of the bishops was dragged into the dust, and they were helpless to force their doctrine on other people. The Saracens' only soldiers were Muslims. Only a Muslim could defend Islam. And there's a parallel here with the ninth chapter of Ezekiel again, verses 1 through 11. Those who grieved over the sins of Jerusalem were marked. They were to remain untouched when Jerusalem fell. And yet when Jerusalem fell, they suffered with the others. Ezekiel's message indicated that their eternal destiny was secure. God just doesn't look at physical death the way we sometimes do. We need to make our calling and election sure and focus on what matters the most. Even the forces of Satan are limited by the bounds of God's providential judgment. God's sealed ones might sometimes be called on to suffer, but the woe was not for them. While open apostasy from Christ is the cause of the fifth trumpet locust scourge. This sealing took place under the sixth seal, and therefore this era of the fifth trumpet must chronologically come after the sixth seal. The word kill is used here in contrast to the extravagant killing which was to occur under the sixth trumpet, which we'll see in a little while. There would be much greater slaughtering there under the sixth trumpet. Here, they were not to annihilate them, but they tormented them. Their power was to torment men 5 months. In verse 5, again, the zoology of the fifth trumpet is all Arabia. The locust, the scorpion. Arabia is the original home of the horse. Arabians are said, and I can't hardly believe this, but Arabians are said to have 500 words for lion. I don't know how that would possibly work, why you would need 500 words for lion. I can see maybe a dozen. But 500 words, 500 different names for the lion. I've never been stung by a scorpion, though I came close once out in Arizona. I understand that it really hurts, but it doesn't usually kill. The Saracens were adept at fighting rearward over the tails of their horses. So viewing the battle from the side, it would seem that the torment that they inflicted came from the tails of their horses, and I think that may be what's being spoken of here. The the map of this part of the world, and I don't know how well that will come across to you. Well, it's coming across better on the screen, I think, than it is on my screen here. The arrows indicate, when they started coming out of Arabia here, where they went. And they went two different directions. They went up this way. Constantinople is right here. Constantinople is not named on the map, but it's right here. And they went up there to try to take over that, because that was the power, the capital of the Eastern Roman Empire. But they also went this direction. So they're going a couple of different ways, also went over here as well. In 634, they took over Damascus, and it's been Islamic ever since. Damascus is the oldest city on earth today that has a continuous existence. It goes way back to Abraham's time. Remember, his servant was Eliezer of Damascus. But ever since 634, it's been Islamic. In 637, they took over the city of Jerusalem. Church houses were turned into mosques. The Dome of the Rock today stands in the area where the Jewish temple used to stand. It was built in 691 AD, if I'm not mistaken. In 638, they took over Egypt. In 675, they were driven back from Constantinople. Whoops! Wrong button. They were turned. You can see the arrow goes up here toward Constantinople, and then they get turned back from it. They later turned back, and they did conquer it, but it took a long time for that to occur. So after they were turned back from Constantinople, they came down here. Whoops! Sorry. Not my favorite thing to do. They come down here and they go conquering along the north coast of Africa, and they finally get to the Straits of Gibraltar and cross over into Spain in 711 AD, and they conquer Spain. In 716, they besieged Constantinople for the second time, and they were rebuffed again by those who were behind those massive, huge walls. So in 721, they crossed over into France, and this is the most extraordinary phenomenon in medieval history. No conquering force has a record that's more amazing than this, and if they had not been stopped in 732 by Charles Martel and the Franks at the Battle of Tours in southern France, they might have just swept clear across Europe. I mean, you don't know what would have happened if things had been different. But you think about Gettysburg, for example. Most people know about Gettysburg. If the Confederates had won at Gettysburg, there was nothing between them and Washington, D.C. They could have gone right over and taken over the capital of the North, theoretically. And the same thing would be similar here. If they hadn't been stopped in France, they probably would have swept across Europe. The Arabs became dominant in a large part of the lands that had been part of the Roman Empire, and they had a tremendous impact. They removed a lot of power from the apostate church. In many places, it was almost blotted out. People had a choice between two major powers. You could either be taken over by Byzantium and be put to death if your faith was different from theirs, or be taken over by the Arabs and pay tribute but have some freedom of worship. Now, I don't want to make it sound too good. All Muslims were second-class citizens, but at least they could live under certain conditions. Christians in Muslim countries were referred to as dogs. They could not use arms. They had to pay a special tax. They had to wear distinctive clothing. They could not build a Christian meeting house. They could not ring church bells, but generally, at least they could live. There was at times an indescribable abuse of Christian women, and sometimes oppression and abuse became so bad that death was chosen over life. It wasn't until shortly before Columbus sailed that Ferdinand and Isabella finally expelled the last of the Muslims from Spain. They were very deeply rooted and a strong influence on any nation that they gained a dominance in. In verse 7, the crowns of gold that are mentioned there are probably their turbans shining in the sun. The faces of men, distinguished from women, would be the bearded face. The shaved male face is one of the lasting legacies of the Westerner, Alexander the Great. But these Easterners did not shave. You heard Ali say that Muhammad's beard fell to his breast. Verse 8, the hair of women probably refers to long hair. And again, you heard Ali say that Muhammad's hair fell to his shoulders. The teeth of lions probably indicates their tenacity. They were mighty warriors. Verse 9, coats of mail, the sound of their wings, the noise of a cavalry army moving along. Verse 11 indicates that the real leader of all this was Satan or one of his chief angels. He inspired Muhammad, giving heed to seducing spirits and doctrines of demons, 1 Timothy 4, verse 1. The 5 months in chapter 9, verses 5 and 10 corresponds to the life cycle of the locust, from the springtime hatching to the death in the fall. Verses 5 and 10 indicate 5 months with 30 days to a month for a total of 150 days. We have not yet talked in our class about the so-called day-year theory, but I am an advocate of it and a believer in it, and I really think it's more than a theory. I would base it in part on Numbers 14:34, where the number of days that the spies were allowed into the promised land to check it out before they made their report to the people was 40 days. The Lord said, since you didn't believe me and you were in there for 40 days to gather your evidence, you're going to have to wander for 40 years each day for a year. And in the same vein, we have Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 6. Ezekiel was supposed to lie on one side for so long and the other side for so long. And it was a representation of a small thing. This little city that he was laying siege to represented a big city and a whole country. And similarly, he would lay on a side for a year, and each day represented a year. And that's said explicitly in Ezekiel chapter 4, verse 6. A little thing symbolizing a big thing. One rotation of the earth on its axis, a day, representing a revolution of the earth around the sun, a year. Miniature symbols of time resemble the scale of miles on a map. 1 inch equals 50 miles or whatever. So I believe the day-year theory has been proven to be more than just a theory. I think the 9th chapter of Daniel by itself shows that the 70 weeks or the 490 days must be 490 years. Otherwise, the Daniel timetable cannot possibly bring us up to the time of Christ. 70 literal weeks is less than a year and a half. The day-year principle, to me, stands proven as fact. Therefore, 150 days means 150 years. And there are a couple days ways of dating this. I mentioned that Muhammad began his public preaching in 612, and 150 years later, in 762, their capital was moved from Damascus to Baghdad, where the Caliph Al-Muzar built on both sides of the Tigris River, the new city of Baghdad, and Baghdad was called the City of Peace. Gibbon said that at this time, quote, war was no longer the passion of the Saracens, end quote. But it's also possible to begin with the death of Muhammad in 632 when the Islamic armies left Arabia and began conquering other countries. 150 years from that brings us to 782 when the Caliph Harun al-Rashid in Baghdad was involved in friendly correspondence with so-called Christian rulers. And there was a great blossoming of Islamic Muslim culture there. This was the time when Islamic society reached its greatest zenith of wealth and learning and power. This was the time of the Arabian Nights, the 1001 Nights, and al-Rashid is a central character in that literary work where he is portrayed as the epitome, as the learned of the learned and just ruler. The Muslims actually took the literary classics of antiquity and translated them out of the original Greek and Latin into the Arabic language and preserved them. Later during the Renaissance, when Europe was coming out of the Dark Ages that we saw them heading into this morning after the destruction of Rome, during the Renaissance, when Europe got interested in learning again, they translated a number of their classics, which by that time had been lost in the original, translated them from the Arabic back into the original languages. Baghdad, at its height, was known as the City of Peace in the reign of al-Rashid. So the Saracen conquest was ended, and they ended into what is known as the Golden Age of Islam. Now today, about one out of every five people on the earth is a Muslim. 1,300,000,000 of them the last time that I checked, and the number grows as we speak. By the year 2025, Islam is expected to have 2 billion adherents on the earth. It's the fastest growing of the major world religions, driven by high birth rates in the third world. There are more than 7 million Muslims in the United States at this time. It's one of the fastest growing religions in America. The greatest tension between the Bible and the Quran pertains to Jesus Christ. There is an inexorable, permanent incompatibility there. The Quran depicts Jesus as a mere prophet. If Jesus is who the Bible claims he is, then the Quran is fictitious. The Quran denies the historicity of the crucifixion of Jesus, as well as denying the resurrection. The New Testament says if Jesus did not rise, then the Christian faith is false. The revelations of Muhammad sound amazingly like the latter-day revelations of Joseph Smith Jr., the Mormon prophet, especially the ones on the subject of polygamy. In both cases, their revelations admonish their first wives to be receptive to their polygamy. Muhammad consummated one marriage with a 9-year-old girl. Her name was Aisha. She was the daughter of Abu Bakr. Islam is a perverse system. Need to get to the text here. Whoops. That's okay, the text of the second, of the seventh, the sixth trumpet, sorry. Second woe, sixth trumpet. Let me just read that. Verse 13. The sixth angel sounded, and I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar which is before God, saying this to the sixth angel which had the trumpet, loose the four angels which are bound in the great river Euphrates. And the four angels were loosed, which were prepared for an hour and a day and a month and a year for to slay the third part of men. And the number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000,000, and I heard the number of them. And thus I saw the horses in the vision, and them that sat on them having breastplates of fire and of jacinth and brimstone. And the heads of the horses were as the heads of lions, and out of their mouths issued fire and smoke and brimstone. By these three was the third part of men killed, by the fire and by the smoke and by the brimstone which issued out of their mouths. For their power is in their mouth and in their tails, for their tails were like unto serpents and had heads, and with them do they hurt. And the rest of the men which were not killed by these plagues yet repented not of the works of their hands, that they should not worship devils and idols of gold and silver and brass and stone and of wood, which neither can see nor hear nor walk. Neither repented they of their murders, nor of their sorceries, nor of their fornication, nor of their thefts. This sixth trumpet is the sixth in an intensifying series of judgments. And this one is even more severe in its consequences than the previous one. It's a judgment resulting from the idolatrous corruptions in the apostate church. And I think that's indicated in the last two verses there. The worship was corrupted by pagan elements, and I've indicated this a little bit already, but it's really a striking point. The incense altar standing at the entrance to the most holy place is the symbolic vehicle for the communication with God. The prayers of God's people ascend with the incense in chapter 8, verse 4. The word of God comes from the altar back to the people. When Hezekiah cleansed the land from the sins of his father Ahaz, blood from the sin offering was applied to the horns of the altar of incense. And by this, accompanied by repentance and fervent prayer, God defeated Sennacherib and sent his armies retreating back across the Euphrates. We read about this in 2 Chronicles 29 and 30 and 32. Here in Revelation 9, the voice from the horns of the altar warns an unrepentant people of the impending judgment from beyond the Euphrates, the primary major international boundary line between the threatening powers of the East and the more Western world was the Euphrates River. Four often reflects the four directions, north, south, east, and west. These forces are to come from a site on or near the Euphrates. Just as the angel was arrested over Arana's threshing floor in 1 Chronicles 20, so these angels have been bound at the Euphrates River until they are now going to be loosed. I think there are a number of reasons for believing that this power that's referenced in the sixth trumpet is referring to the Turks. The Turkish power is the one that rose on the decline of the Arabic power and was the next important power affecting the destinies of the world. The Turkish power had its seat in the East and would probably be classified properly under the events occurring there. The Turks completed the downfall of the Roman Empire, which is the object of these symbols, after all. The Roman Empire under the Turks fell to rise no more. In verse 14, it talks about being bound in the Euphrates, or restrained by it. In 1057, Toghrul Beg left Baghdad on a career of conquest. That was the loosing of the four angels. In a few years, mosques had been built all the way from the Euphrates to Constantinople. That arrow that you saw going toward Constantinople a while ago on that map. As Muslim institutions were established, making further and further inroads, there had been mosques established all the way along there. And the Eastern Emperor at Constantinople was sitting there trembling on his throne. But verse 15 is probably the part that we want to look into, the hour and the day and the month and the year. Again, I would apply the day-year principle to this, so that a year would either be the prophetic year of 360 days, or it would be the solar year. And the word that's used here seems to refer, well, it does refer to a revolution or a repetition. A revolution or a repetition, the literal expression is that which returns unto itself. A solar year, so that would be 365 and one-fourth days, or 365 and one-fourth years. The month of 30 would be 30 more, a day would be one, and then an hour. So we think of a 24-hour day in our time and place, but in the Bible, there were 12 hours in the day. Jesus asked the question one time in John chapter 11, verse 9. Are there not 12 hours in the day? So rather than being 1/24, this would be 1/12. And when we add them together, we'd come up with 396 years and 4 months. 4/12 equaling 1/3. 4 months is a third of a year. After the demise of the Saracens, the Seljuk Turks captured Baghdad in 1050 AD. The Turks waged war westward from their capital in Baghdad. Baghdad was located in the very place where the Tigris and the Euphrates converge most closely together, facilitating the construction of irrigation canals required between them for the agriculture needed to support a large population. The Seljuk Turks are in the 11th, 12th, and 13th centuries. They began the fulfillment of the sixth trumpet. The Ottoman Turks began in the 14th century, specifically 1326, with a man by the name of Othman, and they completed the fulfillment of the sixth trumpet. On January the 28th, 1057, the angels were loosed from the Euphrates. They started out on this expedition, and finally, they made it to Constantinople again for the last time, and were successful, and the fall of Constantinople was on May the 29th, 1453. So the subtraction there gives us 396 years and 4 months. The fall of Constantinople was accomplished after a 52-day siege, which was remarkable. And the third part of men just refers to the Eastern Roman Empire. The Turks have remained there at Constantinople and that whole country ever since, and they're still there today. They have their own country now. It's called Turkey, and that Turkey country is 98% Muslim. The importance of the fall of Constantinople to the Ottoman Turks can hardly be overestimated. They eventually changed the name of Constantinople to Istanbul. That didn't happen until the 20th century, but it was headed that way a long time before that. When I was a boy, there was a song about that. Remember that? Istanbul, not Constantinople. Istanbul is Constantinople. That's the way it went, wasn't it? Istanbul is Constantinople. Anybody else know that song? I used to hear it. My mom, only mentioned her because she just passed on, but she used to have a little wooden radio on top of her refrigerator, and she'd turn it on and listen to, I guess it was modern music at the time, back in the early 50s. And I think that song was later redone by They Might Be Giants, if I'm not mistaken. I wouldn't have known that, but some kids were telling me that lately. Every gal in Constantinople lives in Istanbul, not Constantinople. So if you have a date in Constantinople, she'll be waiting in Istanbul. Why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks. So these songs can be educational. The real question becomes, why did this take so long? After the second woe has been let loose, it was no more than 40 years before Constantinople seemed on the verge of ruin by the Seljuk Turks. But then came the Crusades. And that, in one word, is the reason that it took so long. The Crusades were a series of military expeditions organized by the so-called Christian powers of Western Europe against the Muslim powers that toward the end of the 11th century had gained a foothold in the traditional holy lands of Christianity. Jerusalem was captured in 1077, and the first crusade was in 1095, called the People's Crusade or the Peasant's Crusade or the Pauper's Crusade. All those names have been applied to it. They were destroyed. Those people that tried that were destroyed by the Seljuks. Lots of people went on crusades because the Pope would give you a plenary indulgence if you'd go. There were some ridiculous crusades, like the Children's Crusade, where it is said that thousands of children died expecting a miracle, expecting the sea to just open up for them when their feet touched the water, and they never even reached the Promised Land. But their idea was, God is with us, we cannot fail. There were at least 10 major expeditions of the Crusades. 1444 was the last important crusade against the Ottoman Turks. In addition to the Crusades, there was Genghis Khan and Tamerlane, showing the progress of the Turkish woe. But the Turks eventually got the job done. Genghis Khan and Tamerlane slowed them down, but they got the job done and took over Constantinople. In verse 16, talking about the fall of Constantinople in 1453, we have the expression myriads of myriads. Gibbon explicitly speaks of the myriads of Turkish horse overspreading the Greek frontier. The Turks were known more than any other people for counting their horses in myriads. A myriad was 10,000. The Greeks had a word for 100, and a word for 1,000, and a word for 10,000, and these were used in figurative and round type ways. So this is twice 10,000 times 10,000, but it's an indicator of the Turkish superiority in mounted cavalry. Probably intended to indicate an incalculable number of horsemen. It'd be like saying, too many to count. John said, I heard their number. Apparently he heard that from an angelic messenger. In verses 17 through 19, the horses and the riders are introduced as a composite symbol. Riders on horses, mounted troops. The Turks were well known for the use of horses in warfare. In the armies of Western Europe, the majority of the fighting men were foot soldiers, with just a minority of knights as cavalry. But the Turkish armies consisted of cavalry, which were extremely swift and powerful. The colors here are very interesting. The fiery red, the dark blue, the dusky blue color of sulfurous smoke, the yellow. The Turks introduced the use of gunpowder in warfare. And the Battle of Constantinople was one of the very earliest usages of gunpowder in warfare. So here we have, I think, a veiled allusion to a variety of warfare which was completely unknown in John's day but would become prominent in later times. Gibbon, always the unconscious commentator on the apocalyptic prophecy, describes the Battle of Constantinople. The volleys of lances and arrows were accompanied with the smoke, the sound, and the fire of the musketry and the cannon. The Ottoman artillery thundered on all sides, and the camp and city, the Greeks and the Turks, were involved in a cloud of smoke, he said. The Sultan Muhammad had 67 cannons. The smallest one of his cannons could shoot a ball of 200 pounds. The largest of his cannons had a bore of 3 feet and could shoot a ball of 1,200 pounds. That one was drawn by 70 yoke of oxen and 2,000 men. Tremendous piece of equipment. Remember the walls of Constantinople that I mentioned a little earlier? Now for the first time in their many efforts to overtake this city, they were in a position to use not only huge slings made from bent trees, not only to use the battering rams of huge logs suspended and swinging, but now they could use explosive gunpowder, fiery red, smoky blue, sulfur yellow, to tell the story of the battle which ended the Eastern Roman Empire. The Turks had guns as well for their horsemen, and the horsemen would lay low on their horses and place the gun between the horses' ears. And as they fired, if viewed from the side, it would appear that the blue smoke of the powder was issuing from the very mouths of the horses. Verse 17. The mouths are viewed as the principal killing agents here. Another thing about the horses' tails. The Turks did something that nobody else did, to my knowledge. They used the horse's tail as a standard. and as the symbol of office and authority. The pashas of three tails had three horse tails on the sides of their tents. The pashas of two tails had two, and beys were honored with one tail. Why? Why would they do this? How did this happen? Early in Turkish military history, as the story goes, they lost their standard in battle. The Turkish commander at that time, in his moment of extremity, cut off the tail of his horse. He lifted it up on a spear and made it the rallying ensign, and in this way won the battle. I have read that this standard or ensign was used only by the Turks and among no other people. In this way, their ability to spread desolation was connected to the tails of their horses. In verse 20, we read about the rest, and I think it's referring there primarily to the Church of Rome, but also the survivors in the Greek Church. The temporal sovereignty of the bishops of Rome was now firmly established. Every scheme to bind Italy together in any other way had proved abortive, and the Roman See maintained its ascendancy over the Italian powers. The prevalent religion of that day was superstition. The Bible was practically unknown. Those who survived did not repent, and this speaks of the hardness of heart. There were murders, according to verse 21. How many murders? I don't know. But millions of murders, the persecution to death of the faithful who died believing what you and I believe from the Word of God. They were persecuted to a cruel death, marked out like sheep for the slaughter. The Turkish invasion had no tendency to produce repentance for this or a reformation of this. Sorceries are mentioned there, pretended miracles, imaginary magical deceits, puppets, relics, images of saints that are supposed to have some spiritual significance to them. All sorts of other paraphernalia were alleged to perform miracles in exchange for payment. Always in exchange for payment. This is the great horror we're talking about. She works for money. In most cases, there were deliberate deceptions involved here. The priesthood working on superstitious credulity, just as it had in the case with the pagan heathen of years before. Fornications are mentioned here. There were concubines for the priest. Gibbon states regarding this period that it would be difficult to find anywhere more vice or less virtue. Pope Alexander VI, at the close of the 15th century, stood before the world as a monster notorious to all for his impurity and vice. Most of the ecclesiastics had mistresses, and all the convents of the capital were houses of ill fame. In exchange for money, licenses were issued by the church to celibate clergy, giving them permission to live in fornication with concubines. Also, thefts are mentioned here. In 1516, Tetzel was sent out as a friar to drum up support for the indulgences. He went all over the place preaching that you can pay money to get your relatives out of purgatory. Just think of it. Just listen to the voices of your dear dead relatives and friends saying, pity us, for we are tormented in this flame. You have the power to release them, for as soon as the coin in the coffer rings, the soul from purgatory springs. And it was this that turned Martin Luther's stomach when Tetzel got near where Luther was living. It was this that was the flashpoint for Martin Luther to cause him to nail his 95 Theses for debate. I mean, Luther was a Catholic. He was an Augustinian monk. He was on the Pope's side, but he said, this cannot be right. If the Pope has power to release people from purgatory, he's cruel if he doesn't get them all out of there right now for free. So that was the flashpoint for him. Thefts, it's been all about the money, and St. Peter's Basilica, as it stands in Rome today, is built by the sale of these indulgences. The worship of saints was a Christian substitute for heathen idolatry and hero worship, and it well suited the tastes of the barbarians. Praying to the dead as intermediaries came into the church from heathen custom. Praying to Mary or other departed saints displaces the sole mediatorship of Jesus Christ. Though the Catholic Church attempts to distinguish between veneration and worship, the verb used in canon law legalizing and promoting such saint worship was the Latin equivalent of proskuneo, the word used here in Revelation 9:20. I went and talked with a lady in Chicago a few years ago. She was a friend of a sister in the congregation I was working with up there at Itasca. I sat with her in her home and talked with her for a couple hours. She was a Roman Catholic. I sat with her and talked with her for a couple hours. When I got up to leave, she said, "What do I owe you?" I said, what do you mean? She said, well, when I talk to the priest, I have to pay. It just makes you feel so bad for people. The great whore is all about the love of money. Money for favors. Money for elevation to sainthood. Money for the creation of new images, enshrinement of relics. It's a complex engine to bring wealth and power to high places and to deceive and impoverish the common people and estrange them from the Lord's simple way. It's a sad, putrid system. You wonder what God has to do to make men turn. Apostasies never turn back to God as groups. I've never known of a single incident of this occurring. Individuals can come out of an apostasy and are encouraged to do so. Come ye out from among them and be separate and touch not the unclean thing. But I've never known an apostasy to turn back to God as a group. Once you go down that road, the group does not turn back. The first four trumpets followed one another in history as they do in prophecy, in rapid succession. The fifth and the sixth, as we have seen, which in the prophecy are treated as far more permanent, are also far more fully described, and they correspond in history with powers that last decades, not just decades, but they last for centuries. We have come here to the point which is the end of Edward Gibbon's books, and you can be glad about that. He concludes with the fall of Constantinople on May the 29th, 1453. However, when we get into the little scroll, we'll be going back in history a ways, so don't count too many blessings yet. The sixth trumpet takes us from approximately 782 to 1453 A.D. This era is the time when most of the excesses targeted in verses 20 and 21 were institutionalized in the Church of Rome. I don't take any joy in talking about religious groups that may even possibly be represented by somebody's here. Certainly, if you are here and you are from the Roman Catholic faith, there's nobody who's any more welcome to come and study the Bible with us than you are. We're glad you're here, and we hope you'll continue to be here and let us get to know you. But we have to tell the truth about the system. There's a difference, I think, between being the system and the slaves of the system. We want to work with anybody who has an interest in following after truth. Throughout this era, there was a faithful remnant. And that faithful remnant is addressed and addressed distinctly as the prophecy unfolds. When we go to chapter 10, we may be able to do this just really briefly here. We've traced the fall of the Roman Empire in the west to 476 A.D. and in the east to 1453 A.D. But Satan tried to duplicate the Roman Empire by setting up a religio-political structure. Satan has always been a counterfeiter. When God sent his son, Satan set up the Roman Caesar as the son of God. Caesar Augustus was literally known as the son of God. Christ sent apostles, the devil sent false apostles. The apostate Roman church became a counterfeit of the Lord's church, and it became so perverse that there was a call for reformation. The only way to reform is from within, and a man from inside of the counterfeit church brought about the reformation. The next five chapters of the book of Revelation form an excursus or a digression of a supplementary nature. They interrupt the sequence of the three major series of symbols, the seals and the trumpets and the bowls. This section is placed in the center of the book and plays a prominent role in the message and ends, I believe, in chapter 14 with a proleptic harvest scene of the final judgment. There's an extraordinary angel that presents a little scroll to the Apostle John. After the analogy in Ezekiel chapters 2 and 3. I believe the little scroll contains its own message, which is structurally independent from the sequence that's in the seven-sealed scroll, except that it does contain the sounding of the seventh trumpet. The message of the little scroll is found prior to the resumption of the seventh trumpet, which is, I believe, is the outpouring of the seven bowls introduced in chapter 15. The temple and the two witnesses in chapter 11 set the stage for chapters 12 through 14 by introducing the war between the beast and the people of God in its setting, which is the temple of God. This was an institution that was supposed to be regarded as the church. So 11:14 is a structural indicator, and 11:15 through 18 is a celebration of the sound of the seventh trumpet, a heavenly scene similar to the last part of chapter 7, celebrating future victory. 11:19 is a transitional statement regarding God's temple and warning of future judgments. And we'll talk more about the little scroll, Lord willing, tomorrow morning.